Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the October issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Reba McEntire visiting Red Steakel in the bunkhouse. Red. Reba, thanks for taking the time to visit with us. Reba, my pleasure. We go way back to 1974 when we first met. Some ways it seems like yesterday, and also seems like we've just known each other forever. I know a little bit about where you grew up and how you grew up, and I want you to tell the folks how you grew up, what your life was like. Reba, I grew up on an 8,000-acre cattle ranch in southeastern Oklahoma, a little town called Chalky. It was Mom and Daddy, Alice, Pecky, Susie, myself. We were the hired hands along with Louis Salmon, and we worked hard. And when Daddy would release us from our desires, we played hard. Pack, Pecky, and I would run up the front of the house singing, anything you can do, I can do better. And we were competitive always. All four of us kids were very competitive, mainly because Grandpap, John McEntire, was a world champion steer roper. Daddy, Clark McEntire, was a three-time world champion steer roper, and Mama was a school teacher and bookkeeper there at Kiowa, Oklahoma, where all us kids went to school. We had a blast on the ranch. We loved it. We worked hard, as I said, played hard, too. One of Daddy's relatives one time asked, Clark, you need to put a fence around this house now. Daddy said, what for? He said, well, because they get rattlesnakes up there. You know that, and one of them kids might get bit by a rattlesnake. Daddy said, well, they're never at the house anyway. They're always down at the roping pen. You can't put a fence around that whole thing. You also grew up in the world of rodeo, a very unique community. When did you start riding a horse? Do you remember? Well, the first time I ever was in competitions, I was 11, running barrels. But I've been riding forever. It was one of those types of things where you thank God for Grandpap and Lewis because Daddy would give us instructions, and about half the time he was looking off pointing, and we didn't hear a fourth of the instructions. We'd wait until he got out of earshot, and then we'd say, Grandpap, what are we going to do? What do we do? Grandpap would say, oh, okay, this is what we're going to do. We'd just get up. We didn't know where we were going or what we were doing half the time, but we faked it because we didn't want to get in trouble. And evidently, we got the job done. La Puerta Originals. When is a door so much more than a door? When it's a historic and artistic statement from the skilled craftsmen at this magical collection in Santa Fe. By Lindsay Welchel. Before you walk through La Puerta Original's expansive outdoor antique yard in Santa Fe, prepare for a true treasure hunt, and you'll want to allow plenty of time to wander the approximately 4 acres filled with pieces from around the world. Here, you're making your way not only through exciting inventory, but also through history. Rows and rows of exquisite doors that are hundreds of years old, from places like Mexico, South America, Egypt, Morocco, Pakistan, lined up alongside old hardware, antique decorative corbels, large wooden columns, unique pieces of metalwork, and so much more. The whole experience comes as a wonderful surprise. Who could have imagined what treasures awaited you, what antique pieces would call to you, and what the team at La Puerta Originals would do with your treasure once you discovered it? Credit Scott Coleman for this trove. Since the early 1990s, Scott has been collecting antique doors from around the world. An architect, custom home builder, and artist at heart, he would incorporate the doors into his designs. Pretty soon, the doors filled up his garage, then his driveway, and eventually, he had to start renting space to accommodate his growing collection. As Scott began using these special doors more and more in his home projects, people caught on to the beauty of them and began to seek them out exclusively, even when he wasn't building the person's home. There was only one problem. The antique doors weren't designed to fit contemporary door openings. Soon, Scott was operating his own shop to make the doors suit housing specs, and La Puerta Originals was born. Scott's wife, Melissa, took over ownership of the company in 2003. Scott remains the founder and creative director. Now, the husband and wife duo, along with their team of around 20 craftspeople, operate out of an 18,500-square-foot production facility, where they make the past come to life again, day in and day out, for clients across the country, one puerta at a time. Initially, it was primarily doors and cabinetry, but the offering has quite expanded into pretty much whatever a customer can imagine of any millwork goods, from staircases, driveway entry gates, coffee tables, benches, and beds, to jaw-dropping doors you'd have to see to believe. The company might have 100 different projects going at any one time. It kind of runs the gamut. It really kind of is the sky is the limit. But our main focus is doors, and then secondarily, it's now kitchens, Melissa says. At the moment, it's a kitchen going to California, a large order of doors going up to Boulder, Colorado, and an old world door requiring 72 tiny nails being hammered into a unique design for a couple in Texas. Every day that we come in, there's something new going on, Melissa says. The company sources one-of-a-kind antiques from multiple countries and combines that with reclaimed wood from structures across the American West. These are building materials that are otherwise being demolished and scrapped, but hold so much history and authenticity, in addition to being the more sustainable option for building materials. Melissa explains the company currently buys about 150,000 board feet of reclaimed lumber every year. A lot of the material we have is several hundred years old, so the older the better. The quality of the craftsmanship is better, and the wood is more durable. Old growth wood lasts for many, many centuries, even when exposed to the elements. La Puerta Originals then remills the wood and incorporates the antique material into it to create a finished and seamless piece. The best part? The pieces function flawlessly in modern settings, but they come with a piece of history. And that's exactly what is resonating with customers. I think people are really starving for something unique and something different. They're looking for something that tells a story, Melissa says. You can get any kind of machine-made door at your heart desires, but everybody has those doors. It's not different. It's not unique. If you want something handcrafted just for you, for your home, there aren't many places that do that. Everything we do here is by hand. Melissa praises her team of highly skilled craftspeople, most of whom have been with the company for decades, and she's also quick to credit Scott for bringing his artistic visions to life on paper and then to fruition in a way that makes customers' dreams materialize. I think the most incredible part to me is seeing an idea that comes out of Scott's head manifest into an actual door, she says. Melissa tells the story of one of their customers, a married couple in Kansas, for whom La Puerta Originals built a beautiful door for their farmhouse. It quickly became clear the couple had something special when they started to hear that folks in their community would often drive out past the farm just to look at the front door. They love it. They're very proud of it, and it's exceptional quality. It's just a showstopper, she says. The couple have since returned to purchase other items for their home from the company. A lot of La Puerta Originals sales are, in fact, repeat customers and referrals. The company also works with architects and some home builders across the country. When their client wants something truly spectacular, beautiful, and high quality, They know where to come, and they come to us. When you come to La Puerta Originals, by phone, online, or in person, you can expect to take a walk, or virtual tour, through the antique yard, and then sit down with Scott to come up with a vision for your home. From concept to finished piece, the process can take several months, or more, depending on the project. The company works with clients every step of the way. It's an amazing process, Melissa says. There aren't that many people who do this for a living because it takes an incredible artistic boutique offering what we provide and not a lot of people to do that on the scale that we can do it. Though Melissa has been in the business a long time, even she's still surprised by what their company can do. When you're running a business, you can get a little bit down in the weeds of the day-to-day, but something will come off the workbench and it will be stood up and it will be so incredibly beautiful and so special that you just have to stop and really appreciate how the process works. It's an art project from start to finish. We really do love the material we're working with, so we take a lot of care with it, and we try to make everything the most beautiful thing for our clients. For more information on La Puerta Originals, visit lapuertaoriginals.com. Hot to Trot. Say so long to one-size-fits-all trailers and basic barns. Today's equestrian set is looking for luxe lodgings, both at home and on the road. By Laura Castelny. Wide open spaces have never been more appealing. The events of the last few years have given people permission to move away from densely populated cities, focus more on family, and realize their dreams of becoming horse owners. According to the American Horse Council's latest stats, there are more than 7,246,835 horses, both recreational and commercial, in the United States. That means there's also a bigger need for horse transportation and housing. While in the past those were considered practical matters, today that's not the case. More and more owners are demanding top-notch technology, unusual upgrades, and high-end finishes in their trailers and barns. These are a few of the innovators who are making that happen. Wheels of Fortune. Not all horse trailers are created equal, and that's in large part due to the efforts of Randy Bloomer. As the owner and founder of Bloomer Trailer Manufacturing, he has spent almost 25 years leading the charge for custom equine transportation. It all started after a particularly tough weekend of travel. I showed horses all day at the Fort Worth Summer Spectacular, and then I went to Baton Rouge, he says. It was late, it was hot, and we didn't have rotations in the old days. We had to wait it out. Eventually, Bloomer competed and then made his way back to Texas. By 2 a.m., we stopped to get a drink, and I noticed one of the smaller horses in the manger was bleeding. I couldn't figure out why, he explains. It turned out his manger was too tall, so he couldn't get his head down to drain and relax. He was grinding his nose and part of his gums. That's when Bloomer realized it was high time for a design change. For a while, horses were changing the discipline size-wise every 8 or 10 years, he says. For example, Western discipline horses may want a smaller stall, while English discipline horses may require a larger stall, and so on. The standard was no longer working. As a dealer, he figured he'd meet with the manufacturer and pitch his 4 or 5 ideas. Unfortunately, the company was less than interested. They were very nice, and they were very politely told me, that's the way they've always done things, he says. I was distraught. I was only 33 at the time, and I really looked up to them as business people. If Bloomer was down, he was most definitely not out. An hour later, he called his wife, and though he doesn't like swearing much, he told her, I'm going to do it my own and kick their asses. He leased a building in Lamar, Texas, next to the Union Carbide plant. Those breezes were something else, he says with a laugh, and set up shop. He began sketching plans on everything he could find, including a Denny's napkin or two, and hired people who shared his vision. I wanted to build big trailers with living quarters, and I figured out that the most ignored segment of the population was the high-end buyer, he says. I wanted everyone to feel like they got a one-of. That was about 7,000 trailers ago. While the size of the team has grown over time, Bloomer's son, Jake, has even come on board, and manufacturing has since moved west to a better location in Salado, Texas. The company's core values remain unchanged. If I look someone in the eye and say this is the best money can buy, I sincerely want to mean it, Bloomer says. The spirit of innovation also continues. One-of-a-kind wraps extrusions and wheels are available for the exteriors. Inside, his company can carve out quarters for up to 12 horses with a tack room on the side. We make it all as custom as a client wants, and as long as we feel it is safe. Someone may ask for 12 saddles in their tack room, and we'll have saddles and bridle hooks that we space out. Maybe we'll realize we need another 6 inches there, so we change it right there on the specs, he says. We do a lot of medical fridges, hot and cold water, fans, and even spa trailers with water treadmills that a horse can use to exercise and get well at the same time. Despite the thousands of trailers he's built in the past, Bloomer is anything but bored. In fact, he remains just as excited about his new ideas as those first 4 or 5 he had back on the day. I love thinking of ways we can improve. 50% of my ideas never work. There's a pile of mock-ups that fail that the guys call Randy's gut pile, he says. But it's immediately copied when something does work. That keeps us all pretty snappy. One task Bloomer Trailers doesn't take on is twirling up extra luxe living quarters. For that, clients typically hire an interior designer or partner with a specialty firm like Outback Customs. Located in Oklahoma City, Outback works with a number of high-end trailer makers, dealers, and clients to create totally custom interior design schemes featuring luxurious finishes like leather, quartz, and hardwoods and appliances, such as washers and dryers and dishwashers. We welcome people to come here in person because it makes the process much easier. But we're also happy to work with clients over the phone and email, says interior designer and sales manager Lisa Pelliti. I'll put together mood boards and samples. I've got stained, glazed, and painted cabinets, as well as flooring options, tile backsplashes, sinks, and so on. Aaron Weimer started the company back in 2012 and immediately found a demand from clients who wanted a glamping experience up top that was more befitting folks who own and train the million-dollar horses housed down below. Business only grew during the pandemic. Our buyers were wanting to get trailers and get away from people. We had lots of new clients buying for the first time and repeat customers who wanted to upgrade to larger ones, says Pelliti. As business boomed, so too did the fun requests. The designer says they're open to any and all ideas as long as they can safely fit within the confines of the trailer. We've been asked to do all kinds of doggy doors, wine barrel sinks in the bathrooms, backlit crown molding. We even did a liquor dispenser with bottles stored in a bay down below. Raising the barn. Providing proper equine shelter has always been a top priority to horse owners, but these days, stables are anything but staid. Designers and craftsmen are stepping in with barn upgrades ranging from sculptural stalls and Dutch doors to automated watering systems, chandeliers, and well-appointed tack rooms. In fact, barns are becoming so fancy that more and more people are looking to move in. Case in point, barn dominiums, the housing of choice for folks who have a little land and a lot of imagination. After converting a shop into a family-friendly home a few years ago, Liv Berg was so sold on the possibilities that she launched Montana-based Back 40 Buildings in 2019. Today, her team designs metal, stick-built, and post-frame barn doors. There's basically two avenues. You can find and click on a plan on our website, or you might see it on Pinterest, TikTok, or Instagram. Then we make tweaks based on a client's needs or budget, Berg says. But we also love working with people who come to us with their own drawings and doodles. Whether the plan is stock or totally custom, Back 40 has a network of manufacturers who work together to facilitate the exact design and then the home kits that are shipped across the nation. Business is booming. The company's designs went up in 37 states last year. And while every client wants something a little different in their steel structure, Berg notes there are some things that remain non-negotiable, no matter the region. People want lots of windows, big covered porches, and the more modern single slope roof lines, she says. For buyers looking for something a little less heavy metal, the Barnyard builds 17 classically inspired models perfectly suited for modern uses like garages, event venues, commercial projects, and yes, barns that ship all over the country. Everything is done the old-fashioned way with pegs. No nails, says Everett Skinner, who runs the Connecticut-based family business along with brother Chris. We obviously take advantage of modern technology and use CNC to cut pieces. That helps out make our barns more affordable with a quicker lead time. Everything from design to manufacturing and shipping is done under one roof. Many of our barns are designed to replicate structures built in the 1800s, explains Skinner. So they come with all the joinery, details, and configurations you would have seen back then. Once customers select their barn of choice, the Barnyard team gets to work pre-cutting the entire project, ships it, and once it arrives on site 3 or 4 months later, they can send a team to actually raise it. Because everything is pre-cut and numbered, we can build an entire barn without having to take out a saw, he says. It usually goes up in 2 days. It's actually a really fun experience. People invite friends and family and people from the community. When it comes to putting together the interiors, Skinner says that people's approaches are changing. Barns have become an extension of the home, he says. That means the materials, finishes, along with the design budgets, are mimicking what's going on in the main house. The same goes for creature comforts. People are looking for a setup with a great television and a pool table. They want something that's really special for family gatherings, he says.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier, October 2022 edition. Yellowstone Prevails by Candy Moulton. In early June, Yellowstone National Park, which is celebrating its sesquicentennial year, was hit with heavy rain and fast snowmelt, causing devastating flooding. The natural event wiped out roads and bridges, took houses and other structures off their foundations, and floated them down rivers. Campers and visitors were evacuated, and the park immediately shut down all entrances. It appeared that the park would be closed for weeks. But the National Park Service, under the direction of Yellowstone Superintendent Cam Jolly, showed that sometimes even the great federal bureaucracy can move quickly. Within days, some roads were reopened, and just over a month later, the entire park was open to some degree. A lot of work needs to be done to recover from the flooding within the park and in nearby communities. One message came out loud and clear in the aftermath. The communities are resilient and open for business. The flooding and closure caused tremendous harm, damaging businesses and closing many of them down during the peak summer tourist season, which they all rely on to make it through the long winter months. The hardest hit area within the park was the north section, including the roads from the northeast entrance at Cook City, Montana, to Mammoth. The park headquarters at Mammoth remained operational, but many visitor services were curtailed and only started reopening in late July. Temporary roads provided access between Mammoth and Gardner. Some other roads in the northern part of the park were so heavily damaged they could not be quickly reopened. In late July, the Beartooth Highway from Red Lodge to Cook City, Montana, had been reopened. That high-elevation highway is nothing short of spectacular and worth driving just for the views. While Cook City's main tourist season is in the summer, the community does remain open during winter and is a place to visit if you like winter sports, like snowmobiling. Because the Beartooth Highway closes when snow hits the area, the access to Cook City during winter is through the Sunlight Basin and over the Chief Joseph Scenic Highway. This is another stunning drive to make as you travel to Cody, Wyoming. Red Lodge is open. In June, floodwaters tore through downtown Red Lodge and damaged structures, but there are many reasons to visit, including the chance to stay at the Pollard Hotel or visit the Carbon County Historical Society and Museum. Other attractions include the Yellowstone Wildlife Sanctuary and art galleries. In the summer, visitors can take a ride in one of the iconic Yellowstone buses, which aren't your standard buses, or hike nearby trails. Red Lodge is a good winter destination, too, with Nordic ski trails and downhill skiing on Red Lodge Mountain. Flooding really took a toll in Fromberg, Montana, located along the Clark Fork River. Volunteers from surrounding areas and even other states came to this small town of around 400 residents to help with the cleanup and rebuilding efforts. Despite the setbacks, there is plenty to do in Fromberg, including visiting Clark's Fork Valley Museum, which is housed in a railroad depot, but has other structures, including a homesteader's cabin and a one-room doctor's office. Don't miss Columbus and Livingston, Montana. Columbus, Montana, at the confluence of the Stillwater and Yellowstone Rivers, also faced flooding. If you visit, take the time to see the Museum of the Beartooths, with exhibits about the Apaseluki Crow Indians, the railroad, early settlers, and local businesses. A trip to Columbus is not complete without stopping at the New Atlas Bar, which opened in 1916 and is on the National Register of Historic Places. From Columbus, head west along the Yellowstone River to Livingston. When Lewis and Clark returned from the Pacific Northwest and Fort Clatsop in the summer of 1806, they split their party in western Montana. Clark, with several men, plus Sacagawea and Toussaint Charbonneau and their son, Jean-Baptiste, eventually traveled across southern and eastern Montana, following the Yellowstone River back to its confluence with the Missouri River. The route took them through the area where Livingston is now located. Learn more about their journey in this region at the Yellowstone Gateway Museum. This facility in a 1906 schoolhouse also interprets other transportation history, like the arrival of the Northern Pacific Railroad. The Livingston Depot Center, located in the Northern Pacific's railroad depot that was built in 1902 and which served as an important point for travelers headed into Yellowstone National Park, hosts exhibits, art exhibits, and events for all ages. Livingston is still a gateway to Yellowstone, reached by driving through the peaceful Paradise Valley. To the south is Chico Hot Springs, which has a swim-up bar, an eclectic selection of lodging options, and good dining. Gardner, Montana, open for business. Gardner is Montana's true gateway to Yellowstone National Park, and this small town felt the effects of the Yellowstone region flooding in June as the raging floodwater carved the riverbank, causing houses to literally fall in the maelstrom and float away. For a few days, the town was virtually cut off, but Gardner is both tough and resilient. It proved that a couple of years ago when a fire tore through the business district. This year, the flooding resulted in lodging properties and other businesses being cut off and closed temporarily, as many roads were damaged or completely obliterated. but as soon as access could be restored, the town began its rebound. Plan a visit, West Yellowstone and Jackson and Cody, Wyoming. While Yellowstone had reopened by late July, the access from the north end of the park was still restricted to Mammoth, with only essential employees allowed to travel one old road, which was once the stagecoach route. Work was underway to upgrade the roadway and improve conditions for the public, but that didn't mean it was impossible to get into Yellowstone from the northern entrance. Private tour companies had some access to take visitors into the area, even though visitor services were still limited at Mammoth. Communities on the west side of Yellowstone, including West Yellowstone, the primary entrance to the park from western Montana and Idaho, were not hit by significant flooding, but they were affected as visitors changed their plans and entered the park through that entrance. Similarly, Jackson Hole, Grand Teton National Park, and the town of Jackson saw an influx of travelers. Those communities are always busy in the summer, as they have a variety of lodging and dining properties, along with many things to do. Tour operators in West Yellowstone maintain services into the park, including through the north entrance at Gardner. This is also the busiest park entrance during the winter, with snow coach and snowmobile tours operating from their base in West Yellowstone. Reservations are required for winter trips, but the chance to see Yellowstone when snow covers the landscape is certainly worth the effort to arrange such an excursion. While some of Yellowstone's wildlife hibernates or migrates out of the park during winter, other species are certainly around, including bison, river otters, coyotes, wolves, bald eagles, and more. Pahaska Teepee, located near the east gate entrance to Yellowstone, is Buffalo Bill's original 1904 lodge and has a range of lodging options, from small cabins to facilities suitable for large families or groups of friends. Hiking trails and horseback excursions are popular with visitors to Pahaska. And along the north fork of the Shoshone River, between Pahaska and Yellowstone's East Gate and Cody, are several other lodging properties. Like Jackson Hole, Cody saw an influx of visitors in the immediate aftermath of the flooding, because people were unable to get into Yellowstone. This small city can handle such a crowd. However, with its unparalleled attraction, the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, the five museums at the center appeal to various interests, from Western art and firearms to the story of Buffalo Bill Cody, natural history, and Plains Indians. Buffalo Bill's Irma Hotel is always a good bet when in Cody, but you can shoot Wild West-era firearms at the Cody Firearms Experience, walk through historic buildings at Old Trail Town, or stroll along Sheridan Avenue for shopping and dining options. Unfortunately, the sesquicentennial of America's oldest national park was not quite what everybody expected. The flood that hit the region, which has been called a 500-year event, proved that nature is unpredictable, but it's also resilient. Plan your own trip to the park or one of the nearby communities and help with the rebound. True West Magazine, October 2022 edition. Cannibal Correspondence by Kellen Cutsforth. The most celebrated Colorado convict was wooed and loved, despite his life sentence for eating his camping compadres. Why do some women become infatuated with heinous serial killers and mass murderers confined in jail cells? Why, in some unusual cases, do they go so far as to open communications with these men? Mental health professionals refer to this disorder as hybristophilia. In popular culture, the ailment is referred to as Bonnie and Clyde syndrome. The condition is usually characterized by a woman who will communicate with a high-profile criminal to try and kindle a relationship with them. This syndrome is not solely a 20th-century phenomenon. In fact, the most notorious cannibal of the Old West, Alfred Packer, or Alfred, depending on which spelling you accept, received fan mail from several adoring women while he was incarcerated for his crimes. Packer is infamous for committing cannibalism during the winter of 1874 after guiding a group of five men into Colorado Territory's San Juan Mountains during a horrendous snowstorm. After arriving by himself at the nearby Los Pinos Indian Agency, Packer spun a story about his comrades having left him while they searched for food. He stuck to this tale, saying he was unaware of what happened to his companions, even though he carried large sums of their money and possessed a rifle known to have belonged to one of the men. Packer's flimsy account was questioned by those who knew him, and he was soon arrested. Under interrogation, he admitted to partaking in cannibalism. However, he denied committing murder. Following Alfred's incarceration, the mutilated bodies of his five companions were discovered, and most historians conclude that the remains were found near the Gunnison River by an illustrator for Harper's Weekly who was on assignment in the area. The corpses showed signs of intense violence, with fractures of the skulls consistent with blows delivered by a hatchet. Following this discovery, Packer escaped from jail and went on the lam for nearly 10 years until March 1883, when he was discovered in Douglas, Wyoming, living under the alias John Swartzy. After this arrest, Packer was put on trial, convicted of murder, and sentenced to death for killing some five other persons for their money and a vicious desire for human flesh and blood. During sentencing, the judge famously uttered the words, "I sentence you, Alfred Packer, to be hanged by the neck until you are dead, dead, dead." However, Alfred would escape death on a technicality and receive a second trial. At the outcome of that trial, Packer was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to a 40-year prison term in the Colorado State Penitentiary in Canyon City. Throughout his incarceration, Packer maintained his innocence, saying he only acted in self-defense when attacked. Perhaps the most prominent woman to champion Packer's cause while he was in prison was the popular journalist known by the pen name Polly Pry. Supposedly, Polly, whose real name was Leonel Campbell Ross O'Brien, received her nickname from fellow reporters because they said she had the ability to pry information out of anyone. Pry first met Packer and interviewed him while researching an article about Colorado's prison system, focusing on the Colorado State Penitentiary. Polly, who was also the first female reporter for the Denver Post, believed Packer to be innocent of murder. She used her column to argue that since sailors were legally allowed to eat people if they were lost at sea, the same rules should apply to people stranded in the mountains. Through the popularity of her Packer column that brought increased revenue and readership, Polly persuaded the owner of the Post, Harry Tamman, to pay for Packer's defense and demand a retrial. The retrial eventually led to a pardon for Packer on January 7, 1901. But before Polly Pry helped secure his eventual release, Packer received a constant stream of the curious who came to ogle Colorado's nationally known prisoner. Along with the influx of onlookers coming to his prison cell, Packer began receiving loads of letters from adoring well-wishers. One of these sympathizers was Mrs. Rebecca A. Newman. Born in 1846 in Herkimer, New York, Newman worked as a school teacher while residing in the Bronx neighborhood of New York City. By opening communications with Packer, she apparently hoped to form a friendship with him and express her sympathy for his circumstances. When Colorado's governor-elect Alva Adams learned of Newman's affections, he warned her, writing, "If you knew Packer, knew his career, and was acquainted with all the details and surroundings of this horrible crime, that you would not care to be his defender and to offer excuses for his conduct." Not dissuaded by Adams's alarm, Newman insisted communications be open anyway. In 1887, he relented and forwarded her letter to the state penitentiary. Disturbingly, Rebecca implored Packer to delve deeply into his crimes and give a full, detailed statement of the whole circumstances connected with your most extraordinary trials and sufferings. Alfred, unsurprisingly, was willing to comply. Detailing his account to Newman, Packer stuck to his story of self-defense and only committing cannibalism for survival. However, he did divulge several interesting details about his ordeal. Before the deaths of his five companions in November of 1873, Packer lied to those men and 15 other miners near Bingham Canyon, Utah Territory, telling them he had the ability to guide them to Colorado Territory's rich precious metals region. Because of his ineptitude, Packer caused the men to slog through the San Juan Mountains for nearly 2 months, only covering 250 miles at a meager average of 3 miles a day. After wandering in the wilderness, the beleaguered party was eventually discovered by war-painted Ute Indians. Among the Ute braves was Chief Oray, who took them to a spot near his village where they set up a makeshift camp known as the White Man's Friend. Oray exchanged food and supplies with the travelers while advising them to shelter at their encampment until the winter passed. However, a contingent of five men, George Noon, Shannon Wilson Bell, James Humphrey, Frank Miller, and the elderly Israel Swan, wanted to reach Breckenridge before thousands of fortune hunters descended on the area. These men would be the five who, on February 9, 1874, foolishly followed Packer into the maw of a ferocious storm. The hope of this contingent was to reach the Los Pinos Indian Territory, the closest outpost to Oray's camp, and from there head to Breckenridge. Addressing these events in his correspondence, Packer attempted to deflect blame for leading his comrades to their doom by throwing Oray under the wagon's wheels. He wrote, "From conversations with the Indian chief, the noted Oray, we learned that in his opinion, we could reach the Los Pinos agency in not only 5 days on foot across the mountains. I had never been at the agency and was only guided by general reputation and information received from Oray." Packer was a known pathological liar, and the account he gave to Newman concerning Oray is not entirely truthful. Oray never told Packer that they were only 5 days from the Los Pinos agency because there was at least 3 to 4 feet of snow blocking their path. In fact, the prospectors who remained at the camp stated, "Oray told them they would all die, and that he had not an Indian in the band that would go to show that route, as they were afraid of the deep snow." However, when Oray realized Packer's party was still going to stupidly stagger into the storm, he graciously provided them with provisions. Alfred wrote that they were given scanty fare, about 20 pounds of flour and not over 10 pounds of good meat. Oray also drew a crude map on the ground with a stick, giving them all the directions he could as a route. Somehow, these men still did not grasp the desperation of their circumstances and trudged on. Not surprisingly, Packer told Newman, "At the end of 9 days, the last provisions had been eaten. We ate our goatskin moccasins and subsisted on rosebuds until we were weakened and emaciated and mentally completely distracted. Those conditions clearly led to the deaths and cannibalization of all in Packer's party." Alfred also attempted to downplay going on the run for a decade, telling Newman, "I was not arrested or even censored by anyone until 1883 when I was arrested, though I was in the country and seen by all men during all the time." This is also a ridiculous statement, considering Packer was living in a different territory and under an alias for the very reason of evading capture. While in prison, Packer often crafted leather belts, bridles, wooden canes, and watch fobs fashioned from dyed and braided horsehair. He normally sold these items as souvenirs to the gaping gawkers visiting him. However, he would occasionally gift one of these items to people he thought were special. He gave a chain bracelet to Rebecca as a sign of his affection and desire for a relationship. Like most manipulative criminals, however, Alfred clearly had hidden intent. Through his correspondence with Newman, he hoped to find out what she could do for him. Packer wrote, "I will make you proof I am worthy of the aid of the philanthropic and those better situated than I am financially or otherwise." Newman died in 1926 at the age of 80. Packer died alone in 1907 in Littleton, Colorado, a suburb of Denver, at the age of 69. Whether Newman and Packer ever met is lost to history. But women like Newman still exist today. They play a dangerous game when contacting famous criminals who are experienced manipulators. And for those who do not proceed with caution, sometimes end up being eaten alive. True West Magazine, October 2001 edition. Vanished by Tim Simmons. When the Civil War broke out in 1861, one foe the Confederacy did not anticipate was the Mescalero Apaches of western Texas and central New Mexico. Federal forces pulled out and headed east, leaving the territory wide open. Lieutenant Colonel John Baylor of the Department of Texas of the Confederate Army was ordered to take 7 companies of the 2nd Texas Mounted Rifles and garrison some of the abandoned forts in West Texas, which included Clark, Hudson, Lancaster, Stockton, Davis, and Fort Bliss, which was just outside of El Paso. The 87 men of Company D were assigned to Fort Davis, which was east of Fort Bliss, under the command of Captain James Walker, a 48-year-old physician from Lavaca County, Texas. Baylor had bigger plans, however, and pressed his offensive into New Mexico territory to take it for the Confederacy. To do so, he needed all the men he could get, and soon Captain Walker moved on to New Mexico, leaving 2 young second lieutenants, Reuben Mays and William White, in command at Fort Davis with 25 men. While the Confederates initially enjoyed success against the federal forces in New Mexico, they had serious problems to their rear. The Mescalero Apaches were also enjoying success as they attacked Confederate supply trains headed for New Mexico. They had all but halted traffic between San Antonio and Mesilla, New Mexico, where Baylor had his headquarters. The Apaches were also killing Confederate scouts. Baylor realized something had to be done, so he ordered Confederate Commissioner James McCarty, currently at Fort Davis, to seek out the Mescalero leaders and establish some sort of terms to keep the Indians from attacking the Confederate supply lines. One crafty Mescalero leader, Nicholas, was known to have an absolute hatred for the white men. However, with the promise of food and gifts, he agreed to meet with McCarty at Fort Davis. The meeting appeared to be successful, and McCarty invited Nicholas to accompany him to El Paso and meet with James McGoffin, the Confederate Peace Commissioner. Again, there would be food and gifts, and Nicholas would get to ride in the white man's stagecoach. The Apache leader grinned. That would be a good story to tell his warriors. Nicholas made the trip and met with James McGoffin and John Baylor, who also lost no love for their enemy. The Mescalero leader received presents, and it appeared that peace would reign between the Confederacy and the Mescaleros. The white men made eloquent speeches. Nicholas had something to say in return. "I am glad I have come. My heart is full for my white brothers. They have not spoken with forked tongues. We have made a treaty of peace and friendship. When I lay down at night, the treaty will be in my heart, and when I arise in the morning, it will still be there, and I will be glad I am at peace with my white brothers." McGoffin made arrangements to provide rations and blankets for the Mescaleros, and they would join the Confederates as scouts. James McCarty had to be quite pleased as he and Nicholas rode in the stagecoach back to Fort Davis. Not only had he solved the Mescalero problem, but now the Confederacy had new manpower to add to their ranks. McCarty and Nicholas talked amicably during the trip. Then, about 20 miles east of Fort Davis, Nicholas suddenly pulled McCarty's pistol out of the holster and leaped out of the rumbling stagecoach. Before McCarty could say anything, Nicholas disappeared into the night. McCarty sat quietly and thought about it. Perhaps things weren't quite as blissful as he had believed. A few nights later, on August 4th, 1861, Nicholas and 2 other Mescalero leaders, Antonio and Espejo, led 200 of their warriors to the Fort Davis pasture. they slaughtered a large number of cattle and took about 100 horses. The next day, a man showed up at Fort Davis and reported that the Mescaleros had attacked the ranch of Manuel Musquiz, about 6 miles away, killing 3 men and stealing most of their livestock. No doubt about it, Nicholas wasn't living up to the agreement, and something had to be done. That same day, 2nd Lieutenant Reuben Mays led a detachment out of Fort Davis to deal with Nicholas and his Mescaleros. Mays really wasn't the best man to be chasing after Apaches, and he didn't have enough men. He was a 26-year-old man from Lavaca County who had no military experience at all. He was just fulfilling his military obligation. Prior to the war, he had been a carpenter who studied law on the side. When he rode out of the fort on that hot Texas day, he led 6 troopers and 7 civilians. All of his soldiers were just like he was. They were young men from Lavaca County who had never fought in battle. They carried a variety of rifles, pistols, and knives. Mays had a Mississippi long rifle, a Bowie knife, and a watch, all of which he borrowed from Lieutenant White. Among the civilians were John Woodland, an Englishman who clerked for the post sutler, and John DeProse, a Canadian teamster. 3 post guides went along as well, John Turner, Juan Fernandez, and an unidentified Mexican. Fernandez didn't speak much English. The Texans followed the Mescalero's trail for several days, and in the late afternoon of August 10th, they made camp. They had no idea they were just 3 miles from the Mescalero camp. However, as they scouted around the area, they found some horses and stolen livestock grazing in a small canyon. As they started rounding them up, they saw the Mescalero camp. It was almost too good to be true. They had actually stumbled onto the Indian camp. Most of the young Texans wanted to charge up the canyon and hit the Indians in a hard surprise attack. Mays had to think about it. Did they really have the element of surprise? After all, they had been rounding up livestock for a while. Was it possible the Mescaleros had seen them? Reuben Mays didn't think it was a good idea. Neither did Juan Fernandez. But the young, cocky Texans from Lavaca County wanted to attack. After all, they had been left out of battle with the Yankees, and now they wanted to fight. The Indians were just up the canyon. Mays relented against his better judgment, and they rode into the canyon. They didn't get very far. In fact, the Mescaleros had been watching their every move. The canyon suddenly roared with gunfire, and Mays saw several of his men topple out of their saddles. Apaches seemed to be behind every rock and tree, materializing right out of the ground. Mays yelled for a retreat. The Texans jerked their reins and dug in their spurs. Mescalero warriors jumped on their horses and immediately gave chase. At least 100 Apaches now pursued about 10 frightened Texan Confederates. A few more of Mays' men were dropped in the running battle. When the white men got back to their camp, they jumped off their mounts and took up a defensive position behind a large boulder. The Mescaleros quickly swarmed and had the Texans surrounded. The young men fought for their lives, but the odds were overwhelming. One by one, the remaining white men slumped over or flayed out when bullets smacked into them. Mays was hit in the arm, the bullet breaking the bone. He handed the Mississippi rifle to Fernandez since he couldn't operate it with one arm and continued fighting with a pistol until he was killed. Fernandez found a rock ledge, climbed up to it, and hid under it with the seriously wounded Jack Woodland. A few minutes later, the dust settled on that hot Texas evening and the moon shone down on a grisly scene. On August 15th, Juan Fernandez, exhausted, dirty, and bloody, showed up at Fort Davis. The worried Texans were eager to hear what happened to their comrades. In his broken English, the Mexican tried to tell them. Lieutenant White sent out a relief column of 19 men, both soldiers and civilians. Fernandez led them to the site of the massacre, evidence everywhere that a battle had taken place. They found dead horses, including the one Mays rode. They also found his pistol and the blood-stained waistband of his corduroy pants. There were other hats, boots, and articles of clothing. The only corpse they found was the badly decomposed body of John DeProse. It could only be identified by the clothing. Juan Fernandez climbed up to the rock ledge where he had left John Woodland. He too was gone, but his pistol was left behind. The maze fight is one of the biggest mysteries in Western lore. Apaches usually stripped their victims, took weapons, mutilated the bodies, and left them for others to find. This time it was the reverse. Weapons and clothing were found. Bodies never were.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.